Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. For almost a year, it was not allowed to challenge the West Ukraine is winning narrative. That is beginning to change. Military math will always trump the most sophisticated and well-funded propaganda. Wasting another $100 billion will not change the outcome. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guests, Glenn Diesen in Oslo. He's a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway, as well as author of the book, Great Power Politics in the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And in Budapest, we have George Samueli. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Glenn and Oslo. Oslo, I think you'd both, all of us would agree that Robert Gates and Condoleezza Rice essentially speak for the foreign policy blob of the United States. They co-authored an article which was titled, Time is Not on Ukraine's Side, which I think all of us would agree, but for very different reasons. Basically, both of them, with their very flawed foreign policy past when it comes to foreign military adventures, are essentially saying the United States has to escalate with more money, more troops, more material. How do you take that? Because you could say, you could take the exact opposite position. Yeah, it's not, they're not winning. Maybe we need to reassess this policy, but they're not, Glenn.
Well, yeah, it is an interesting article because, again, time is not on Ukraine's side. It's another way of saying Ukraine is losing. And also that's what they are outlining in their article. So militarily, they have suffered heavy losses. The infrastructure is destroyed, especially the electric grids. The economy is in shambles. It's going to be hard to recover a lot of this because a lot of Ukrainians have now fled the country, except, you know, for the men who are not allowed to leave. And, it's an interesting admission that the war is still going on because it's completely funded by NATO countries. Now, this is not my words. These are their words. They're saying this is the only reason they're being kept alive now, continuing this war only because of NATO. Now, this is interesting because it creates a dilemma of narratives. Because on one hand, we're told that, you know, Ukraine is winning, it's winning. You know, anyone who disagrees are Russian propagandists. And this is a way of encouraging to send more weapons to get them to that goal. But this is a same objective, but a different narrative. Like Ukraine is losing, it's losing, we need more weapons. But the objective is obviously the same. It's more weapons. But overall, the fundamentals of the article, I find a weakness. And this is that, again, as you said, it's no reassessment. The only solution is more war, despite it not going forward. And I don't think they think that Ukraine can win either. Again, it's a war of attrition. Yeah. I think the purpose of this is to weaken Russia, so the longer you can keep the war going, and again, throw more Ukrainians at this and, you know, destroy the country more, it doesn't matter. We're not fighting out of love for Ukrainians. We're fighting out of hatred for the Russians. So I think, you know, there has to be some acceptance that the U.S. created a lot of this situation for this war. And again, I can quote many CIA directors and U.S. leaders to confirm this, that the U.S. created the situation. And then the U.S. blocked all paths to peace ever since 2015. And now they keep insisting that military victory is the only solution, even though they kind of realize that this is not even possible. And there's a word for this. It's a proxy war. And this is, again, what we're fighting. And I just resent the idea that we're doing any of this for Ukrainians, because this is not, if you wanted to help Ukrainians, we would have given Russia security guarantees, which wouldn't have created the situation. Again, something that American leaders, CIA directors have all argued in the past as well. So it's the whole situation is very sad. And I think this article by Gates and Rice exposes this.
Yeah, George, in the article referring to Ukraine, the economy is in shambles and the country is entirely reliant on foreign aid. But NATO is not a co-belligerent in this conflict. I mean, how much longer can you keep up this fiction? OK, I mean, as Glenn has said here, without the resources, intelligence and et cetera, money, Ukraine would have signed some kind of terms of termination of this conflict. George.
Yes, no question about that. The article is, of course, very interesting because, as you say, the premises are a little different, but the conclusion is exactly the same. So most articles are Ukraine's winning, so let's send in even more and better weapons so as to they can achieve victory. Here, Ukraine is losing, so we must send in more and better weapons in order to ensure Ukrainian victory. But what's unusual about this article is that it raises the stakes because the analogy of Russia and Hitler is made explicit in the article because it said, well, this is the same as America before World War One and America before World War Two and 9/11, which is that America was delaying entry into a conflict, and then it got much worse as a result of this delay. So if you follow the logic, and then you say, well, if the stakes are so high, and if Ukraine is losing, and Ukraine really has no hope of winning, then what's the next step? The next step is that America has to get involved directly, because it would be like saying that, well, Poland is doing a great job against Hitler. Let's keep assisting Poland so that we can stay out of this war, because if the more we send Poland, the more likely Poland is to win against Nazi Germany. Nobody would have made that argument, but that's the logic of what Gates and Wright are saying. And therefore, we're still in this rather dangerous situation that as long as the United States keeps escalating, as long as the United States keeps saying that this is a, you know, an existential matter for the West, which of course it isn't, then there really is still a danger that NATO will get involved in a very big way and lead to a very serious military confrontation with Russia.
You know, Glenn, George said something that's just very important here. The West says this is an existential threat. It isn't. But the policy that they continue to pursue, in fact, creates those conditions where it's existential because it's all or nothing. As you quite correctly pointed out, you know, for the last 8 years, the West under the auspices of NATO has been driving towards this conflict quite, you know, intensely, deliberately. We know this from Angela Merkel. We know this from François Hollande and other Petro Poroshenko, the former Ukrainian president. So the more they up the stakes, it does become more existential, at least from a reputational point of view, the humiliation of losing this conflict, which is completely unnecessary. The Ukraine has no strategic value to NATO as it stands right now, and certainly not to the United States.
Well, that's what's interesting in this conflict now as well, because as we see that in their words, that the Ukraine is being torn completely apart, the only rational argument is, you know, let's find a negotiation to end, you know, and the human suffering. And essentially now the argument coming forward is, no, we can't do this because it's much greater than Ukraine. It's a fight for, you know, for freedom of the world. So effectively, you know, we're making this a NATO war in our rhetoric whilst on the same hand saying, no, this is nothing to do about NATO. But this is how the conflict's been built up over all this time. And I think it's interesting because it undermines this narrative that we are helping Ukraine, that this was ever about helping Ukraine. I mean, people can, you know, irrespective of what the people think about Russia's military action, I think I would encourage people to think about whether or not we are helping Ukraine. I mean, keep in mind that we are the ones who pushed NATO expansion for, you know, since 2008, despite only then a small minority of Ukrainians wanting it, but we're saying we're helping Ukrainians, despite, you know, the CIA Burns arguing that this would cause a civil war and a Russian intervention, but still we're saying we're helping Ukraine. You know, we toppled the government in 2014 to install an anti-Russian government. It didn't have majority support, it wasn't constitutional, but we say, oh, we were helping Ukraine. So we supported the crackdown on Russian speakers, the political opposition, the media, and we said, well, this was to help Ukraine. And again, finally, when the Ukrainians in 2019 voted for Zelensky's peace platform to mend ties with Donbas and Russia, we were able to pressure him to reverse it. Why did we undermine their democracy again? Or we're helping Ukraine. And then again, you know, we're encouraging the Ukrainian to ignore the Minsk peace agreement, which could have settled this for 7 years. And instead, we arm them and train their army. Why? Oh, well, we're helping them. And this, and worst of all, like 3 months before Russia invaded in December of 2001, the former head of Russian analysis at CIA, he gave an interview to Radio Free Europe, where he argued that the risk for Russia now, of the risk of not invading, is becoming greater than the risks of invading. Why? Well, he said, because the US is now immersing itself so heavily in Ukraine. It's training its army, it's funding it, but also the US also modernizing the ports in Ukraine to fit American warships. So the Russians saw where this was going, and he warned, well, actually, time is not on Russia's side. Now we're forcing them to intervene now because they can't win this war later. But again, we keep calling this helping Ukraine, and just... not to hammer on about
take a swing at that, George, because you and I talk very often. I've always been it's very bewildering to me that you have, and Glenn just did a wonderful introduction here. I mean, first of all, after the coup in 2014, there was scant support for NATO membership among Ukrainians. I mean, consistently, they said neutrality is kind of the best for us, all right? But you have these elites that have been installed in the people that have followed them, constantly backing Western or fulfilling Western demands. And you and I have been watching this ever since the very beginning and just been bewildered about how does this really further Ukraine's interests and the interests of the Ukrainian people. You and I have said it from the very, very beginning, and I still can't understand. Maybe future historians will be able to explain it to us why these elites do it, because they're getting negative returns unless you take into account maybe their personal wealth that they have accumulated. I don't know. George.
That's an excellent question, and future historians will indeed wonder about this. And ultimately, the answer has to be something involving NATO, the rationale for NATO, the logic of NATO, and the need for constant NATO expansion. Because if things back when Viktor Yanukovych won that election in 2010, he did it on the platform of saying neutrality for Ukraine. And Ukraine will not join any military alliances. And Yanukovych changed the constitution. I mean, he basically said that Ukraine will be a neutral country. He won an election on that. And of course, then he was overthrown, you know, thanks to the assistance of NATO member states. And, you know, one of the first acts of the new regime that came to power as a result of the coup was to change the constitution. And then the constitution now states that, you know, Ukraine will be a member of NATO. That it's explicit. There it is. It's in the constitution. So what was this really about? Well, NATO was absolutely determined to expand and to surround Russia with a literal of NATO states, essentially to minimize Russia's influence in the world and end Russia's pretensions to be a great power. They knew what they were doing. I mean, that was the goal of NATO expansion. It wasn't just a supper club where everybody can join and, you know, we'll have a good time. It was done in order to enfeeble Russia.
I guess George, the only other thing we need to know is that how many Ukrainians were they willing to die for this plan to come to fruition? Okay, and having essentially a failed state in the center of Europe. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the Home Edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, Glenn, also, you know, I said in my introduction, you know, the narrative, Ukraine is winning. People are beginning to realize it's a lot more complicated than that and problematic. But what I think is very interesting is that, you know, when these articles come out with Condoleezza Rice and Robert Gates and all that, people in the Kremlin read these articles too. They tend to forget that kind of thing. And I tend to think now, and my thinking has changed, obviously, since the start of this part of the conflict almost a year ago, is that there was a a peace process that the Turks had volunteered. We know that in March of last year, it seemed to get a lot of traction. I actually had a lot of hope that maybe there could be some kind of resolution to the conflict, but then it was through the good services of Boris Johnson, then the Prime Minister of the UK, put that to an end. My question to you, Glenn, is that that is a one and only opportunity, and it's not going to return, because we had the countries that were part of the Minsk process. They didn't keep their word. They lied. Then you have a possibility of ending the conflict early. Again, a NATO country comes in and says no. So I don't see why the Russians would have any interest whatsoever in negotiating anything with any of these people. They have to. They've made it very clear that they will. That the end of this conflict will, when Russia feels that its security has been guaranteed, irrespective of other players in Europe. Your thoughts?
No, well, I agree. I think that the Russian trust in a lot of these peace agreements now has been lost. Keep in mind that after when the riots were going on in 2013-14 against Yanukovych, the Europeans negotiated a unity government, which they guaranteed. And then as soon as it was toppled right after, they abandoned this. And then, of course, you had this leading to a conflict. You having the Minsk agreement. And again, it's not just the U.S. I thought it was U.S. and U.K., pushing hardest to sabotage this, while the French and the Germans were trying to uphold it. But as you correctly pointed out, what we learned now with the interviews of Merkel and Hollande is both the French and the Germans apparently had no intentions of, at least they claimed they had no intentions of fulfilling this. So I think a lot of this, I think the Russians, they do realize what the American strategy has been. I mean, because for the Americans, like we played this movie before in 2004, if you remember, they had the Western backed this Orange Revolution in Ukraine. They stole an anti-Russian government, but then you had, democracy in Ukraine essentially resisting this. And keep in mind that in 2009, that leader we helped install, Yushchenko, he had 2.7% approval rating. He was the least popular leader in the world, and that's when they voted in Yanukovych, and he went for this neutrality. And what is interesting, I would ask people to read a report by NATO in 2011 where it warns that we have now a problem. They called it the article they published was post-Orange Ukraine. And the problem now is we have a government which isn't anti-Russian, pro-NATO, and even the public. We can hardly find any polls which give more than 20% of Ukrainians wanting to join NATO. How can we change this? And again, the Americans have played this different this time. They worked very hard to first topple the government, and once it was done, to change the institutions within. So again, immersing themselves heavily in Ukraine, stamping out anything of Russian culture and language while putting in Russian American weapons. And not to go on, but it does remind me a little bit about the 1870s, Franco-Prussian War, when it's argued that Bismarck, he provoked or tricked the French into invading, because by doing so, you would have this unity within. This is what brought Germany together, and finally in 1871. And I'm not going to go into this, but my point is, encouraging a conflict between the Russians and Ukrainians is a good strategy for NATO, because for the next decades now, Ukrainian nationalism will be heavily anti-Russian. So my point is, it's been very, from beginning, very strong interest in the United States to encourage this conflict, and that's reflected in all of their actions all along.
I think that is such a seminal point, George, because all three of us have studied Eastern European and Russian history quite intensely. And if someone were to say to me 10 years ago that the Americans would eventually get the Russians and the Ukrainians to fight a very bloody entrenched war, I would be very surprised, because that kind of cultural bond has been very longstanding. Even for most people in Russia, they don't really think of what is the difference between us and Ukraine. Only recently has that happened, okay? And I would say a good part of Ukrainians that speak Russian, of Russian heritage, didn't think about it until the Orange Revolution, that was being forced. You must make a choice. You must make a choice. And all through Ukrainian history, the point is, you really don't have to make a choice. And the Americans were able to pull it off. It's amazing. George.
Yes. I think it even predates the Orange Revolution. I think it goes back to the 1990s. when, you know, in the beginning of the NATO expansion movement in the United States, they saw the prize was Ukraine. I mean, it was there. That's the prize. We need to get Ukraine into NATO because that's really going to give headaches to Russia. And, you know, along with this was the soft power, which is to promote Ukrainian nationalism, Ukrainian language, Ukrainian culture, everything to suggest that it had really nothing to do with Russia. And they tried to do that with Belarus as well. I mean, that was, you know, that part of the story is rarely told. But for instance, George Soros was very actively involved in the early 90s in Belarus, promoting the Belarusian language and culture, had the separateness and so on. So from the United States perspective, I think Russia and Ukraine fighting a war, they say, this is great. This is wonderful because it's obviously very painful on the one hand, but it's also militarily, you know, great. I mean, that's, you know, it's, Russia is being debilitated and it's, you know, we're not losing any lives ourselves. I mean, it's the Ukrainians who are doing it. And this argument comes up in the Gates Rice article that we were talking about. And they're saying, well, essentially, hey, Ukraine, you know, is willing to do the fighting for NATO. You know, what a wonderful stroke of luck that we have a country that is willing to do NATO's heavy lifting for us. So it's been a very cynical policy, and of course, you know, there's really no real pretense any longer that it has anything to do with Ukraine. It is all about, you know, trying to weaken, debilitate, and ultimately destroy Russia.
You know, Glenn, ever since the coup back in February of 2014, I've been observing and saying very, very publicly, to the chagrin of a lot of people, is that the more NATO gets itself involved in Ukraine, the more it, quote unquote, helps Ukraine, the smaller and poorer and depopulated the place becomes. Thoughts?
Yeah, well, this is the price we were paying. Again, this goes why, well, what they're paying, which is goes against the whole idea that we're helping them, because that's what I find so grotesque, that, you know, I think we've been exploiting, using them as a dagger against Russia. And again, we've been quite open about this. I mean, some people dismiss it as conspiracy theory, but look through the American think tank reports over the past few years, like Rand Corporation. They very openly state, this is a great opportunity. Now we can just pump in weapons and we can bleed the Russians for, you know, their lives and their treasury, you know, which can escalate as much as will up or down, and then we can exhaust them. And then after Russia invaded, you have, you know, people like Senator Lindsey Graham saying, oh, the structure of this war is great. The U.S. has promised to give all the weapons they need, and Zelensky has promised to send all their young men to the front, and, you know, in a war of attrition where it can weaken Russia like in perpetuity. And the same with Senator Dan Crenshaw. He called this a great opportunity. It's, we can weaken our key adversary without sacrificing a single U.S. life. I mean, it's amazing. And then you have all these other American, you know, politicians and scholars saying, listen, they're kind of reaching this consensus that this is best as a strategy of making Ukraine into a new Afghanistan for Russia, to weaken Russia. Like, at no point does anyone explain why making Ukraine into an Afghanistan, which is destruction of the whole country, is in Ukraine's interest. It's I don't know how else to see this. People shift the narrative. So, well, either you have to be for the Russian invasion or you believe we're helping Ukraine, and then you create this fake polar position. But it's important for people to be able to think a bit independently and argue, what are our motivation in this? Because in any conflict, you want to give people the role. You have the victim, you have the villain, and then you have the hero coming in. My simple point, NATO is not the hero here. The U.S. has not been a hero. I think this has been a very cynical way. We're helping Ukraine just like we're helping the Kurds. You know, we use them as our frontline fighters, and when we're done with them, we throw them away. This is how proxy wars work.
Yeah, and George, something you and I have talked about at great length is that, you know, over the last two news cycles, there's been Russia has debilitated even more of Ukraine's infrastructure. I mean, you know, at what point can a modern military fight, even if it's NATO armed and trained, if there's no infrastructure in the country? This is really, really, I mean, what we're doing is we're facing a failed state, again, a failed state in the center of Europe. Last 30 seconds, go to you, George, go ahead.
No, it's a failed state that somebody's going to have to pick up the tab eventually to bankroll. And of course, it's going to be the Europeans, because the United States isn't going to fork over any money. It never has in the past. And so what the Russians had hoped for decades, which is that they're going to get some sensible policy from France and Germany and Europe, or to say, no, we want stability in Europe. That hasn't materialized. And that's really will be the lesson of this war, which is the complete failure and absence of Europe from any kind of strategic statecraft.
Yeah, the absence of Europe. But, you know, George, considering however you want to define a failed state, there's going to be millions and millions of Ukrainians that will not return to their home country, okay? And that you're going to have an immigration migration problem in the center of Europe for a very long time to come, with very virulent Ukrainian nationalism, which added together, very bad news. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Oslo and Budapest. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.